Welcome to Everything Belongs, a podcast for those living, creating, leading, and thriving while in the deep end of life. I'm your host, Madison Morgan, leadership coach, creative consultant, and speaker. I coach soulful visionaries and go-getting mavericks who desire to create art of their lives and take their work both deeper and higher. In this show, I'll be bringing you an overflow of conversations with my favorite thought leaders, teachers, healers, and creatives who inspire me to live more fully in my own power, worth, and wholeness, along with offering some episodes where I share my own practical insights, behind-the-scenes peeks into my process, and tools I use on my own journey. There will not be much we shy away from here because at this table, everything belongs. Therefore, you can expect me to ask the uncomfortable, juicy questions. You can expect that you'll hear people you disagree with on the podcast and maybe even ideas you've never previously considered. I trust you with your own discernment as we take this deep dive. You can expect to laugh, cry, learn, and be challenged by the guests as they share their diverse experiences and views of the world. It's my hope through learning to see that all of it belongs that you will develop a more sovereign way of holding yourself so you can playfully go after the life, relationships, and career you are made for, to let all parts of yourself have a seat at the table, to lead and create from your deepest truth and become your own source of validation, all because you finally know you're worthy of it. All that's required to get started, that you show up curious and willing. Let's dive in. Hey, everybody. Super happy to have you today listening to Everything Belongs. Goodness, this conversation was such a juicy one. I'm in conversation today with Ali Fallon. Ali is an award-winning author, sought-after public speaker, nationally recognized writing coach, and has worked with thousands of people to realize their writing potential and become published authors. Which, of course, is super interesting to me because writing a book has been on my to-do list for quite some time. And last time I created space to sit down and write my book, I realized that there was more in my personal life to be written in that story. And that was 2 years ago around this time, whenever I used that time that I had set aside to write to instead uncouple from my ex-husband and come out. And, you know, I'm really now living the life that I had no idea would be part of my story. And something that Ali really brings to the conversation is how the way we tell our story really matters. And if you're someone who's followed me for a while in my program, Awaken Her Soul, you know, that was what I really wanted to write my book about, was what I teach in Awaken Her Soul. And that was how I deconstructed my faith and realized the power of telling our stories in new ways and the power of taking back our story and becoming the narrator and not letting unconscious programming or the stories of others or the stories of society dictate our life, that the way that we tell our stories, recentering ourselves as the hero of our story while we deal with our own shame and what prevents us from having an empowered story. Goodness, that is the work. And as I had mentioned, I thought I was going to write a story through that about Awaken Her Soul. But as that program and the work continues to teach me that we are always unveiling more of ourselves, always becoming more of ourselves, and are being presented with choices all the time on how we're going to tell the story of our lives and how we're going to tell our story to ourselves. So this conversation with Ali was super inspiring because I so resonate with the way that she teaches how we tell our story, and also because it's really important to me that I tell my story, whether it's in a book, online, or even just to myself about the past couple years, from healing from a narcissistic home environment to, you know, leaving cult-like evangelicalism and having my faith completely fall apart, to rebuilding that, to building a business, to leaving my ex-husband after 9 years together, to coming out and cultivating this beautiful life I now have. I've realized the power in the way I tell that story really shifts how I feel about myself as a queer woman in the Midwest, as a white woman, and all of the different identities I hold. So I'm really excited for you to hear Ali's story because we share a lot of similarities. Today we're going to talk about her experience of writing and personal growth, how we transform through how we tell our stories, asking ourselves different questions, recentering ourselves and our story, which is, you know, I'm all about being center in your own story. We both talk about divorce because we both have been through divorces after leaving evangelicalism. We talk about finding people who can see us in that process. We talk about healing from perfectionism, navigating shame, finding new ways to relate to people whenever we're telling more empowered stories, feedback, choice, and building capacity to discern other people's agenda, and how writing can help us find our truth. This is one of my favorite conversations on the podcast because we touch on so many of the things I personally love to teach and talk about, and I hope that you so enjoy this conversation. Please take a screenshot on your phone, share it on your stories on Instagram, tag both of us. I would love to see what part of this you're enjoying. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave a 5-star review for the podcast and let me know what you love about it in the comments. I read every single review and it means so much to have your feedback and to hear what you're loving about these conversations. So with that, let's dive into this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Allie, thank you so much for coming on Everything Belongs. Whenever we connected in your Instagram live, I had so much fun and just really enjoyed being with you, being in conversation with you. And so coming and doing it on my podcast feels like a really big honor. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I feel so honored to be here, truly. So thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I would love for you to share your story because it is, vast is the word that comes to mind. Like there's a number of intersections where we share some experiences, but then also you do writing coaching and you're a writer and there's so much there as well. So could you share maybe the most relevant parts of your story that would feel like would give people a taste into what you do and what you're about?
Yeah. Well, I've been working in the field of publishing for a long time. I've been working for the last decade or so with authors, helping them get their books outlined and published and out into the world. And my career took a bit of a turn, in a really positive way, but through a less positive set of circumstances. Several years ago, when I went through a divorce, I left an abusive marriage. And when I left the marriage, I didn't really know what to do with myself. So I just did what I had been teaching other writers to do, which was to write down the story. And at the time that I wrote down the story, I didn't know, I really didn't think I was ever going to publish the story. It was just a way, it was catharsis. It was just a way for me to like see the story, to better understand it. I almost felt like I couldn't stop myself from writing the story. It was like I was pulled into it and I just needed to better understand it. So I wrote the story start to finish and, you know, at first just left it on my computer and didn't do anything with it. And it was 12 months before I started to think maybe there could be some value in sharing this in a little bit of a wider way. So I went through an editing process that was actually probably more painful than the writing process because as I read through the manuscript, I realized this is not the way that I want to tell this story at all. And I don't like the way that I sound as the narrator of this story. And that set me on this path of personal growth, a journey of personal growth that I had been on for a while. Leaving the marriage was a huge step of faith for me. And, you know, it was not only making a decision that I had sworn to myself I would never make. I was never going to get divorced. I was never going to leave a marriage. But it was also effectively leaving the faith of my upbringing because my husband was a pastor and we had planted a church together. And so there was a lot. It was a weighted decision. It was more than just leaving the marriage. It was also kind of leaving the church. And so when I edited the book, it was when I really started to see what I had heard so many people say for so long, which is that the way we talk about our lives affects how we experience our lives and affects what we magnetize into our lives. I started to see that in real time and like very clearly in front of my eyes, that the girl who was telling the story of this failed relationship was telling it in such a way that there was a lot to clean up on my side of the street. So it was a big wake-up call for me. And it has launched me into this work that I do now where I do work with authors who are looking to get published, but I also really encourage people and work with people to help them share their personal story through the written word, because I believe it's transformative and life-changing regardless of whether or not you ever share that story with anyone. So that's a little like window.
Wow. I'm so interested. My curiosity is so piqued, specifically around what you noticed in the editing process. Because I hear this for a lot of writers, and this is not the same thing, but I went back a couple of days ago in my Instagram and was just reading back at how, you know, because a lot of my public work has been just sharing my process and then coaching behind the scenes. And I was like, I don't like these posts.
Yeah.
And it was very, like, bless the people who've been, you know, on the journey with me, but it was, I share so quickly. I never went through like writing everything down and then editing it, that it was all public. And I was like, oh God, archive, you know, like, it's like yeah. Not serving anyone, and also no one's seeing it because it's so old. But I'm curious what reading your writing and reading the story of your divorce and abusive marriage and faith deconstruction, what, whenever you were in it and telling the story, and then when you were out of it and editing, where was the difference in the dissonance there?
Yeah. Well, as I was reading, the biggest thing I noticed was that the way I was telling the story, I was telling it as if I had very little control over the story. And the language that I use when I teach storytelling courses now is I say, I was playing the victim in the story. I wasn't acting as the hero of my own story. And it's so important that we center ourselves as the hero in our own stories, because all of the action in a story is built around the hero at the center. And a lot of people have a ton of resistance to this because they think, like, this sounds narcissistic. I don't really want to be the center of my own story, especially people who are coming out of a faith background like mine are hesitant to put themselves at the center of the story, because they'll say something like, God should be at the center, or Jesus is the center of my life. And the problem with that is, I'm not suggesting that we are the hero of the whole world or like the story of the world, but in your personal life story, no one else could possibly be the hero except for you. And you're not serving anyone by not playing the hero of the story. Your other options are, you play the victim, you play the villain, you play the perpetrator, these are the other options. None of them are good options. So that was the first thing I noticed, is that the way I was talking about what had happened to me, I was talking about it as if I had absolutely no control over it. And, one of the paradigm shifts that I share when I teach other writers how to write their personal story is, I say, the question that I was asking that was driving the story was, how could this happen to me? Or how could he do this to me? That was the question that was driving the story. And stories are driven by questions. We read the story because we want the answer to the question. But sometimes we still tell stories with questions that just aren't that interesting, and the answers aren't that interesting. It's like, we could talk all day about why he did this to me. It's not that interesting. And it's not my story. There's no way for me to ever possibly know that. And it's just not my story to tell. A much more interesting question that I got to as I walked myself through this process of editing was, what makes a woman walk down the aisle and marry a man she does not love? Because that was always 100% in my control. And answering that question was super painful. It took me on a long journey. I didn't know the answer to it when I started, but it's a really freaking interesting question.
I love a good question. I love a good question. When you said that, I got full body chills, because that's so much more interesting.
Yeah.
I'm so much more interested in that than, why did he do this? I'm like, because he's shitty. I don't know. Like, I have like so many responses of like, it's the patriarchy. I have all of these people to blame why he did it, but why did you chose that? It's like, I want to lean in. I want to get to know you, and I want to know what was going on for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I felt about me too. And that feels like a strange thing to say about yourself, but it was like, it took me on this process of self-discovery where I got really curious about what would make, I remember I have a very vivid memory of my wedding day, standing at the top of the aisle and thinking to myself, seeing him and thinking to myself, I don't even know you. So I had this sense that I didn't want to do this, that I wasn't ready, that it wasn't time. And for whatever reason, for 1,000 reasons, I ignored that sense. And I just charged down the aisle and married him anyway. And it's not to re-victimize myself or to blame the victim or anything like that. But I think moving myself out of the position of like, I couldn't have done anything. What could I have done? This just happened. This horrible thing just happened to me. You know, moving me like one seat over into the seat of the hero of the story and recognizing like, you're in the driver's seat of your own life, really helped me see there were some areas where I didn't have control. Things happened to me that were outside of my control, but there were a lot of areas where I did have control. And reminding myself of that gave me the vision and the empowerment and the passion that I needed to create the life that I'm living now, which is not perfect, but it's really freaking amazing. Yeah.
Isn't it like, what came up for me when you said that was, in in the faith tradition that you and I both come from, there's this like marker of suffering that like life isn't really meant to be good. And so like marriage is going to be a struggle, just deal with it. And people who are happy are just faking it. Like there's all of this really strange messaging that is not accurate. And that like you even said, like living a good life, it's not perfect. Even the fact that you have to qualify that, like, of course it's not perfect.
Sure.
And it can be deeply good. I have a very similar memory of my wedding day, a different question, but my question was, how am I supposed to feel right now?
Wow.
And I was like, I don't feel anything. What am I supposed to be feeling? And look, like seeing myself that day, just being like, okay, what is the right feeling I'm supposed to be having for this moment? Because I wasn't having a genuine experience out in my body.
Yeah.
So that is just, wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to reflect on our own personal stories in that way. And I feel like for the most part, we move through our life, unless you've been trained for some reason to be very self-reflective. Most of us move through our lives and things happen to us like this. And you might be subconsciously, you know, telling a story about your life or reflecting on your life. But until we sit down to actually write down the story, most of us don't really reflect on those questions that we were asking ourselves in that moment, or why we made the decisions that we made, or how we really got here. For a lot of people, I find, and I was in this category until a couple of years ago, we're just sort of like moving through our lives and maybe wondering deep down, like, is this it? Is this all there is? Is this all I'm supposed to, kind of like you're talking about, like, is this how I'm supposed to feel about my life? Well, I guess I should just be more grateful, you know, for the things that I do have in my life that are good. So, okay, moving on. But the process of really stopping to reflect and write down our story is really deeply revealing.
Yeah. I'm curious, this, I think I lost it. You said something a minute ago that was so powerful. And it was about, being a victim and telling your story through this lens of this is happening to me. And I find it so interesting because you were victimized. You were in an abusive relationship. And to, in those moments, to say, well, don't be a victim while you're being victimized is very complicated. And it seems like you came to this awareness of the way you were telling it was like re-victimizing yourself and keeping yourself a victim where you weren't anymore.
Yes.
And I'm curious if other people mirrored that to you or if that was something that you came to on your own.
I had some great friends who helped mirror that to me. And also when I left the marriage, I immediately went to see a therapist. When I was in the marriage, I had this, well, the way that I say this will show you how deeply dysfunctional this dynamic was, but I had asked if I could go see a therapist, and my now ex-husband had told me no, that was not okay. He was worried that if I went to go see a therapist, he said, if you go see a therapist, you're going to tell them stories about me from your lens and they're going to think that I'm a bad guy. So, so no, you can't go see a therapist. So immediately when I left the relationship, I enlisted the help of a therapist and I went to a therapeutic retreat center called Onsite. And I really just like dove in head first with, you know, personal work and therapy and really like, so I had people, professionals in my life who were also reflecting back to me what was going on, but I had friends as well, a couple, like really vivid memories. One friend saying to me, don't ever forget that you have choices. And that's a question that will put you in the hero seat of your life really quickly. Don't ever forget, they might be shitty choices, but you have choices.
Yeah.
So friends like that who would kind of call me back to reality and remind me of who I really was. I think it's one thing to reflect on our own life, but I really do think we have a hard time seeing ourselves clearly without someone else also seeing us clearly. And I think this is where the drive comes from for us to, you know, put our process on Instagram or put it into a book and put that out in the world or to have a blog. Or it's actually a really healthy drive to say, like, here's my story. Do you see it the same way that I see it? So it can get a little twisted sometimes with social media and blogs and books and whatever. But I think I just want to remind people, like, that drive to connect with another human being and say, like, do you see me the same way that I see me is actually a really, really healthy instinct.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. finding people who could see me clearly was really important in my healing journey. I had narcissistic abuse, which makes you very unsure about if you can trust what you see.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in that environment. So I was being constantly gaslit of like, that's not happening. That's not real. You're just overly sensitive. You're making this up. And so I came into adulthood with a lot of like, I can't trust my own experience. I don't even know who I am.
Yeah.
And people who, there's some overlap in evangelicalism in the way narcissist abuse in a micro level present. So people who've experienced evangelicalism in radical churches or in any radical context, not just evangelicalism, usually the same tactics are used of gaslighting and crazy making and disconnecting from your intuition and isolation from safe people like your therapist who can support you to see clearly because they don't want you to see clearly.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. And what's been so helpful was really, well, what was difficult is finding people who can actually see you with no, they don't have any skin in the game. Like they don't need you to be different.
Yes.
They can just see you and tell you, were those friends people who knew about the abuse when you were in it?
Nobody knew about the abuse when I was in it. I mean, I was a really good secret keeper for him. And,
wow.
I think I did that in part to protect him and also in part to protect myself, because I knew that as soon as people knew what was really going on, that it would be, they'd be much less supportive of our relationship. And I wasn't sure what to do with that. I didn't know how to leave a marriage. And I think, so there's a lot, like the faith piece of this plays into this. They sort of weave together, because I grew up in a church environment that was very evangelical. You know, you were just touching on this theme of like people who love you and support you without an agenda. And I didn't know what that felt like, because the evangelical church is built on loving people with an agenda. The agenda is, I'm going to love you so that you can see the love of Christ and so that you'll come to our church, our community, that you'll accept him into your heart. And I mean, I don't think that everybody, well, I don't know how much I want to qualify that. I think I grew up feeling like that was just, this was love, was loving with an expectation, loving with an agenda. And so as I grew up in the church, I really tried hard to fit into the boxes that were set out for me. I tried to check all the boxes. I tried to like, you know, like believe all of the different theologies that I was supposed to believe without questioning them. I wrestled with a lot of doubt as a young person. When I got into high school and college, it was a lot about keeping sexual purity and like remaining modest as a woman. I really tried to do those things. I always felt like I was at war with myself. I remember vividly being 15 years old and I'm in the youth group service one Sunday morning and the pastor's talking about predestination and he's reading this verse from the Bible. I don't know where it is, something about how like certain vessels were created for heaven and other vessels were created for destruction. And I remember thinking to myself, I must be the one that's created for destruction because I don't feel like I fit here. This is not like an easy fit for me. I'm struggling with all of these doubts and everything else. And so that really set me up, that feeling like I was sort of like a B-level Christian. I couldn't quite get myself together. I couldn't quite follow all the rules. I couldn't quite make it work. I didn't quite fit. That set me up for the dynamic that happened in my marriage, where my husband was this, you know, he was a pastor at this church. He was very like respected and looked up to. He was admired by people around him. He had this like charismatic personality and a persona, and people were drawn to him and always praising him. And so I was sort of like, he's A level and I'm B level. This wasn't consciously happening, but I mean, in my little girl brain, I was like, he's A level, I'm B level. I have to always kind of trying to like work to impress him and stay in his good graces. And the getting divorced thing was like a part of that whole weird cocktail. It was like, if I get divorced, then this is really going to put a stamp on me where I really never will fit in this church community. So I can't remember the question now. I don't know if I answered it, but I'm trying to paint a picture of that sense of like always trying to like meet the expectation, live up to the perfect picture. And I think what shifted for me at the end of the marriage was I was just like, who cares? Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The A level, B level is so interesting to me, this like hierarchy of worthiness of who deserves to be in and who's out and who's above and who's below. I had a very similar experience whenever I was, you know, I'm only 2 years out now from even admitting I wanted a divorce. So even though all that has happened very quickly for me, it was very recent. And I was super afraid to be like, I'm not getting a divorce because I'm falling in love with a woman. I'm getting a divorce because this marriage isn't working.
Yeah.
And there also happens to be this, that I'm falling in love with a woman, and really fearing, like, and wanting to keep being a queer person secret, not because of people knowing that I'm queer, but because it being like, oh, well, of course she's just the broken one.
Sure.
And so this dynamic of, I've looked back as well in the beginning of my marriage, where my ex-partner was from a very charismatic background of like gifts of the spirit.
Totally.
And I didn't have the gifts. And I remember feeling so, even though I had spoken in tongues a couple of times, I had a pastor tell me, you're just too intelligent for speaking in tongues, that your mind is getting in your way and there must be a sin in your life. You know, like all of these, like trying to, why isn't this working for you?
Sure.
Are you too smart? Are you just, you're the wrong kind of way? Like kind of similar, like, why isn't this working for me? But his family, he came from a background of like gift of the spirit, talking to angels, like really intense. And I just thought, if I just have enough faith, if I just work harder, and I'm going to be able to like cultivate this. And it, I thought it was like a marker of God's signifying that you were enough.
Yes.
And I did not realize that the marriage for me stopped working whenever I realized that I wasn't broken.
Yeah.
That had been so tethered into the beginning of the relationship that was our trauma bond.
Yes. And I mean, you mentioned this before we even hit record, but the, or you said it too on the interview, like the connection between a sort of narcissistic abusive dynamic and then the dynamic that's often present in the church. And for me, once I realized that this dynamic in the evangelical Christian church is predicated on teaching a young person that they are broken from the minute that they get here on this planet, and really driving that point home over and over again, I started to see that connection, and I started to feel really fearful of that, appropriately so, because I'm like, if you need me to feel broken so that I stay part of your community, this is no longer, I no longer have autonomy to choose and to be an adult and to make decisions for myself. I no longer get to be the hero of my story. Mm. I have to stay the victim, or this dynamic stops working. And I think that's what you're touching on.
Yes. And I don't believe my ex-partner to be doing any conscious abusing. I think that we were told like, he's above me.
Yeah.
That's the way these marriages were set up in that dynamic of like, and that he suffered as well in that dynamic, just to be completely honest. Like I had a more leader, like outward personality. And when you're taught that that's wrong, but then men are taught that they're supposed to be more that and less quiet or meek or whatever they are, it's like constant not enoughness, which just created like me making more money was an issue. All of these things became reasons for breakdown. I'm curious, like how you found that you were not broken.
Oh my gosh. Good question. Well, I think I'm still figuring that out, honestly. I mean, it's like when you're taught something from a really young age and it's built into your cells, it's like in your DNA, and you have to constantly remind yourself, and it takes a lot of reprogramming because you grew up in this environment and it's the only environment you've ever known. And I always, it's like a cliche, but I also make the joke, it's like telling a fish, like, how warm is the water? And the fish is like, water? What do you mean water? So I had a moment like that, you know, right before my marriage ended, where I was like, whoa, wake up call. I do not deserve this. I do not have to live like this. And one of my mantras would be, I'm allowed to be happy. I am allowed to be happy. I do not have to suffer needlessly and unnecessarily. I am allowed to be happy, and I can give myself permission to step into a life that would be easier and more fun and happier for me. So that was the genesis of it. But over time, I mean, I bump up against this, and I don't know if I'd be curious to hear if this is your experience too. I bump up against that feeling of shame again and again and again in my life. I'm constantly, like, as a new mom, I'm like, could think of 1,000 reasons why I'm not good enough as a mom. I'm not doing enough as a mom. I'm not. So yeah, I mean, I'm constantly having to retrain myself to say, you're allowed to be happy. I'm allowed to be happy. I have permission to enjoy my life.
Mm. Yeah. Goodness. I got emotional thinking about the shame, because I think if I look at my journey, it's been trying to navigate shame and rid myself of shame and heal the shame and be okay with the shame and all the different ways that it comes up. And I think I wasn't raised evangelical. So my dad became an evangelical. He went to prison when I was 8 and he came out an evangelical. So Christianity and Jesus saved him from his alcoholism, which had really destroyed his life. And so from the time I was born until I was 8, he was in a very destructive relationship with alcohol and had been married 3 times by the time I was 8. So my mom was the first mom, first wife. And so there was a lot of chaos very early. And then my mom married someone who abused me. And so there was an abusive dynamic at home always. And so whenever I found Christianity, it actually, interestingly enough, it felt like the first portal to being free of shame, because I was like, oh, God loves me. And that I felt like I always knew that I was lovable and worthy and didn't understand why I was being abused. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand, like, in with all the different marriages, like there was a lot going on there of like the wives would be, you know, frustrated, because those dynamics are just complicated when people aren't like seeking to like go to therapy and figure out blended family dynamics. So that wasn't a thing in the early 90s that anyone was doing. Yeah, and totally. So I just got like a typical experience of like back and forth and where do I belong? And even unconscious with like adultery and divorce and all of those things, internalizing, oh, I must be the problem. No one even had to say those things. So by the time I found Christianity, it felt like, oh, like Jesus loves me. And it felt like at first a way that shame was eradicated. But as I got older, so I found that around 12, my home life started getting more and more abusive as I got more older. Like as I individuated, it got worse. And so by 17, I was like driving myself to youth group and really seeking like home away from home. And that's when I got involved in radical Christianity. And I'm sure you know the name Mark Driscoll, like really intense, using shame type pastors. And I think that the thing that had really served me about Christianity turned into an abusive relationship over time, because it's what I had known. And so that's like a long way to answer the question. Yes, I deal with the shame, but it comes up in such a different way. Like I don't experience the shame by myself. It's usually a social anxiety because of not being raised in the church and then experiencing like I wasn't doing Christianity right because I didn't know all of the norms. There was like a social shame that had happened. And then dealing, for me, it's been dealing with a lot of, oh, like there's attachment stuff to work on. There's coming from an abusive home and having a high ACE score, just the things that come from having a difficult childhood that actually do make it hard to live and relate to people. And so In my healing, it's been shame, but also shame for having trauma. And in the church, kind of, I feel like you've probably seen this. There were people who came from the church who were like good family people. And they were people who were used as like the testimonial for what God can do when you come from a broken home. And that's the category I was in Christianity. And I felt like my shame and my brokenness and my hurt was exploited for the church. And because it was like, tell the story again and again. So I just got used to reliving my own shame for the benefit of like the greater good.
Yeah. I'm so sorry that happened to you. I mean, I think that there's like, there is a wound that comes from having to play either of those roles, right? It's like I think of it in terms of the victim triangle, like the victim and the rescuer. there's a wound that comes from being in either of those roles. You know, the family that I grew up in, we were like the perfect family. So, and there's a wound that comes from playing that role. And then from playing your role where you're sort of like always on display to like demonstrate to people, you don't ever get to just be you. You have to be like the transformed version of you. And there's a wound that like a comes from that story. As well. Yeah.
It's a weird thing because I think if we're playing one role in the drama triangle, we end up playing all of the roles.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, circling back to being a victim or playing the victim or however you want to put it, when we are victimized, there's often a way that we become the perpetrator in other ways because those are the dynamics of relating that we know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was definitely like the one needing rescue whenever and like put on display in the church, but then I would go back to my family and I would try to be the savior.
Yeah, totally. It's almost like, yeah, you're getting at it. If you don't know, that's the only way that you know how to relate to someone. And I had a therapist name this for me one time. She called it hotwiring a connection.
Ooh, yes.
And I loved that. I've used it over and over again. But when I was dating after my marriage ended, she would say, watch out for the ways that you try to hotwire a connection with someone. So hotwiring a connection for me would be like sort of like reaching out to someone with a crisis that I needed them to help me take care of. That's like, I don't believe that you'll show up for me. And so I'm going to like sort of bring this crisis to you to manipulate you to show up for me because it's the only way that I know how to connect to you. And that was such an epiphany for me. I just started to see how, just like you're talking about, if this is the only way that you know how to relate to people, if it's the only way that you know how to get attention, if it's the only way that you know how to be seen and validated, it will be the way that you relate to people until you learn a new way, until you have to, you literally have to leave the drama triangle. You cannot be any of these things. You have to find a different way to relate to people.
Leaving altogether is like, that has been I think the most interesting and challenging part is now I'm able to see the hooks in the bait. Someone from the church that I used to be like acquaintance friends with messaged me, and she messaged me like every 6 months. And she said something along the lines of, "Hey, Madison, how are you? I'm worried about you. Are you okay? I have an intuition, or I have this, you know, God is putting you on my heart." And I was like, this is like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe. And I was like, oh, interesting. Everything is fine. What's going on with you?
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't know. I just keep hearing your name over and over and over again in my head. And I was like, wow, that sounds like you're not okay.
Yeah, like, seriously.
Are you okay? And I actually sent a full like message. I was like, you know, this feels really contemptuous to me. You only check in with me when you think of me, you think something is wrong. And that's more indifferent to your relationship to me than how I'm doing.
Yeah.
Cause I'm doing great.
Yeah.
And also we're not friends. So if something wasn't doing great, I would not tell you about
it. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, what an incredible response. It takes a lot of maturity and self-awareness to have a response like that. Cause I do think once you've been a part of an environment like this, it's so easy to get hooked. It's so easy to get hooked.
Yes.
By the way, that dynamic is, I think the charismatic Christianity that you're talking about, there's actually a ton of beauty in that. It's like a, you know, when in charismatic Christianity, they talk about a move of the spirit.
Yes.
There is such a thing as a move of the spirit. I mean, you and I are having this conversation and when you say something, I'll get like a wave of chills. That's a move of the spirit. So
mm-hmm.
I believe that there could be a move of the spirit in which you could speak in another language right now, or mm-hmm. you could have a vision for me, or, you know, all these things that like prophetic visions or speaking in tongues or all the spiritual gifts that we talk about in those environments. And yet that environment can foster, engender, and breed manipulation and projection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we have to have a strong sense of self in order to notice when someone is projecting something on you, or if they really do have a vision for you. My husband has a business partner he lives overseas. So they've been working together for a year and a half or so, but I've never met the guy. My husband, I'm sure, has told his business partner things about me, but we've never spoken over Zoom, over the phone, over anything. And, Johnny, the business partner, told my husband to say, like, I had a word that came to me for your wife. And told my husband what it was, and Matt passed it on to me. And it was just a moment where I was like, I'm going to sit with that for a second because this guy's a total stranger. He doesn't know me. Like, I believe it's possible that the spirit of God, whatever that looks like, could give a word to this person who doesn't know me that could be helpful for me. But I get to decide, is this helpful for me or does it have nothing to do with me? Does it apply or does it not?
Yeah.
So I think we have to be really conscientious. We have to be pretty vigilant and we have to have a strong sense of self to be able to exist in that kind of environment where a lot of people are throwing around a lot of things and you don't know where that stuff is coming from. Just because they say it's coming from God. I mean, my ex-husband would use this as a tool of manipulation all the time. He would say like, God told me, God saying to me, the word that God gave me for you is, and it would be like something he wanted me to do, you know? Yeah. So I'm like, it's really easy to throw that around. Like God told me that you're supposed to give me $1 million. Like, well, that isn't that something.
Yeah. I had an ex-mentor who I had to confess masturbation to every week at our meeting. And I was like, why are you so obsessed with me in this way? Like looking back, I'm like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't two-sided. Like she wasn't confiding. It was a thing that I had to do. But in our last meeting, she had a lot of words for me of like that God had given her. And I asked like, you know, I'm talking to God, right? And God isn't saying these things to me. Isn't that interesting? And so I've really taken up whenever I have very vivid dreams and sometimes they're so vivid and I'm like, I feel like, gosh, I want to tell this person the dream I had about them. And I believe, and this is what I said to that person, I believe the dream is for the dreamer. And a lot of dream analysis, people will say the dream is for the dreamer. And if I'm ever like, oh, this is interesting, I want to tell this person, I feel like just asking is appropriate. Like that's something that in evangelical Christianity, consent was never spoken about. And it was like, I have this word for you and now you shall listen. And it could have just, you know, that person might have had concern. Like I have concern, I'm observing this and I care about you, so I'm concerned. But instead it's so wrapped up in a hierarchy again, that yes. I have this, I heard from God and you're beneath me and you need to listen. To where, and this kind of circles back to what we were talking about earlier with being seen and being mirrored, because we often can't always see ourselves clearly.
Totally.
And when we've been in these environments where these dynamics are used, it can be really easy to say, I'm the only one who knows me. As the words I use, I'm the sovereign leader of my life. And then it can push us into hyper individualism where we're actually not open to feedback, where we can't really know ourselves without feedback. And so it's like, how do you discern and how did you discern whose voices to let in after having that experience?
Yeah. Oh, so I want to answer that. And one thing I want to say before I answer it is a lot of times when we talk about like, you know, leaving the evangelical church or kind of being in this post-evangelicalism or whatever, we talk a lot about like the structures and dynamics that are at play and the leaders who use these manipulation tactics. And I do think that's important. But I also want to emphasize that the structures and dynamics that are at play are what they are. They're not going to change. And us talking about them is likely not going to alter them in the slightest.
Yeah.
So the way I like to talk about it is to speak to people who are part of the community, who are feeling like a tug, like this doesn't feel right. I don't feel right here. I feel like there might be something else for me, because I just want to reassure them. Like if you're a person who has received a word from someone else and you think like, that doesn't really fit me, or I just want to encourage you and re-emphasize to you that you don't have to take that for yourself. And also I think we become incredibly susceptible to those power dynamics, to being a victim to them. When you mentioned this, when we don't trust our own instinct, when we feel like I don't have a direct line to God, I'm not hearing from God, I am lacking spiritual input, then we become incredibly susceptible to someone else saying, I heard from God for you. And you're like, oh my gosh, I want to hear from God so badly. I'm not hearing myself. And so I'll take what you're saying as gospel. So I just wanted to say that like, we could, I don't think it's effective to focus our lives on dismantling the system or changing these leaders, or like these have been around for centuries and they're going to continue on in their dysfunctional ways. But for those of us who are participating in these communities, the hope for you is that you don't have to subjugate yourself to those dynamics,
that you have personal autonomy. You can choose to leave. You can choose a different church community, and you don't have to take a word that's given to you from someone else. Anyway, that was a preface to answering your question, which is about how did I know which voices to listen to? And I started paying attention to the agenda that was attached to these voices. So for example, when you're in a church community, one of the agendas is to keep you as a part of that church community. So when I started feeling like I wanted to leave this community or take a break from this community or just like sort of find my own way for a while, I would get pushback from that. People saying, this is the vision I have for you. That God told me this, God said this about you. And it's like, hey, there's an agenda attached to that. You don't want me to do this thing that I'm about to do. And so of course you would have that vision for me. So it was just really about paying attention to who has an agenda and who doesn't have an agenda, which is why I'd be inclined to believe this business partner of my husband's who doesn't know me, he needs nothing from me. He has no agenda for me. So if he has a vision for me, I feel pretty open to listening to it, because what ulterior motive could he have for giving that to me?
I really like that, is just kind of taking a step back. And I think that when you're talking about autonomy and choice, and you mentioned, I took a step back and I evaluated what resonates, what doesn't resonate. Is there anything in here for me? You've given yourself space for choice. And I think if whenever we're out of our deep self-trust, we have choice, but we have less capacity to make choices because we're not taking the time we need to actually hear ourselves. Yes. Because I do believe everyone has choice, like you said, but there are different factors that determine our capacity to be making those choices.
Totally. And one of those factors would be if you've been sitting in a church environment, like the one that I grew up in and like the one I participated in with my ex-husband, where you go to a church community or environment every Sunday and someone stands up on the stage and they talk to you and they tell you how you should feel about your life and what you should believe. And you are not in the practice of listening for yourself, hearing for yourself, connecting with the divine for yourself on your own. And so of course, it would feel scary to step out from underneath of that, like sort of like blanket of protection is how it felt to me at the time that I left my marriage. It feels unnerving. You're like, I don't know. I don't know. What would I even do next? Like, you know, can I make a big decision like this on my own? So I think just even normalizing that it takes you a while to feel like an adult human being who can make your own decisions about something as simple as what should I eat for lunch? So much of the healing for me in the days after I left my marriage was just making decisions like, what do I feel like eating today? I'm going to go get that exact thing, exactly mm-hmm. what I am craving and feeling. I'm going to go to the grocery store and I'm going to pick out stuff that I like and that I want, and I'm going to bring it home to my house and I'm going to eat what I want when I want it. Where do I feel like working today? Do I feel like working at the house, or do I feel like going to a coffee shop, or I feel like going to, you know, wherever it was. So just even making simple decisions like that, I know that sounds so basic, but I think it really points out how little I trusted myself, how much I felt like a kid who was just waiting for mom and dad to tell me what I'm supposed to do next, even though I was 31 years old.
Yeah, goodness. I'm curious to circle it back to your writing practice, because Find Your Voice is one of your programs, and it makes so much sense hearing the details of your story. Why Find Your Voice would be what you've done through this experience, how writing contributed to you finding your preferences and finding who you are.
Writing is an incredible place where all of us can tell the truth. And the idea would be, as we find our voice, that we find other ways and places in our life that we can also tell the truth with trusted friends. You know, for me, it's been in books. I've been able to write down my story and tell the truth in books, like sort of tell the truth to the world, or like on Instagram or a blog, or with my family members, or with my spouse, or, you know, with my friend. With other people in my life, with therapists. So there are a lot of, like, for me, a lot of ways and spaces in my life where I have learned to use my voice and to tell the truth. But it started for me with writing, because the stakes are really low. So when it comes to disclosure, there's no confusion about whether or not disclosure is helpful for us. Disclosing a secret you've been hanging on to or a truth that feels true to you that you haven't been able to say to anyone can actually improve your physical health because it's a heavy weight to carry to be carrying around a secret. And yet sometimes we don't know where it's safe to disclose. Like, I don't know if it's safe to tell another person in my church community. I don't feel like this is for me. I feel like I need to go. It probably isn't safe to tell your spouse. Like, I don't feel like this marriage is working for me. I need to go. And that might not be the first place that you disclose that information. And for me, when I was in the abusive marriage, I didn't have any other safe places to disclose that. I didn't have a therapist. I was terrified to tell my friends. I didn't know what the fallout would be. I felt like it was going to get back to my husband and he was going to be enraged. And I actually feared for my physical safety. So I told the truth on the page. And this is the beautiful thing about the writing process is that we can say exactly what we're thinking, exactly what we're feeling, exactly what's going on with us. And we get to see ourselves very clearly in a way that we might not have opportunities to see ourselves that clearly elsewhere.
Wow. And then what you said about even the editing process of like the truth as you know it in that moment, which changes.
This is to me, the most miraculous and magical part about the writing process is that truth doesn't stay the same. It's not static. Like I can say, I hate my life in writing. And that could be true. It could be incredibly true for me on that day. And it does not stay the same. The truth does not have to stay that way forever. Mm-hmm. You know, you could even say, I want to leave this marriage. And the process of writing about, I've watched this happen for clients before, the process of writing about it could make you realize that you don't want to leave the marriage. You just want to take the marriage to a different place than it has been before. So the act of writing down our stories has this like magical power, a way that it just transmutes and transforms the story that we're living. And I think of it like a co-creation. Like it's not that you get to write your story word for word and you get to sort of like, you know, decide everything that happens to you in your life, but you do become a participant in developing the story of your life. Again, the story always centers around the hero. So the only way the story moves forward is when the hero takes action. When the hero moves, the story moves. So when you start to look at your life like a story, it's not that our lives unfold exactly like stories on the movie screen, but when you start to look at your life like a story, you begin to see that I'm the center of the story. This is my story that I'm living and I'm the center. So when I take action, the story moves. Mm. You know, if I decide to go on a trip to Europe tomorrow, the story moves. Yeah. If I decide to stay home tomorrow, the story is really different. So it's really empowering and exciting to see ourselves at the center of our stories and to realize how much agency we have to shape them for ourselves.
I'm so thankful that you tell this through the lens of storytelling because it makes so much sense whenever I think about the hero of the story. I talk about for the clients I have in Rising Sovereign in particular, we talk a lot about centering yourself in your story. And in that, there can be a lot of that pushback, but thinking about it as storytelling feels so much like an easier point of entry. So yeah. I just fucking love that.
Oh, good.
Do you have space for some rapid fire?
I do. Yes.
Okay. You've already answered this pretty much, but what's your spiritual background?
Evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you know when you know?
I just know. Yeah. It's like a feeling in my stomach, literally. I just know.
What identities have you had to let go of to own your fullness today?
So many. Christian, the good wife. That's a big one that I let go of when I left my marriage. I'm like, who cares about being the good wife? I've become a mother recently and I've had to let go of identities like I'm organized. I have a clean house. I'm on time places. So I feel like our identities are constantly emerging and developing and blossoming. And so there's like an infinite number of identities that I've let go of.
What are you most enjoying learning right now?
What am I most enjoying learning right now? I am learning to surrender and trust to to where my life is taking me.
What does grace mean to you?
I had a yoga instructor who would always say, effort rises and grace falls. So mm-hmm. as you take an in-breath, you think, this is the effort that I'm taking to create change in my life. And the out-breath is just the natural response to the in-breath. That's what grace means to me. It's like, I can work all I want to create what I'm trying to create, or to, you know, like to make something of my little small part of the universe. And grace is just the, it's just the free gift that comes in response to the effort.
I love that. What is your go-to coffee shop order?
I usually get an Americano with some half and half, but every once in a while, if I'm feeling spicy, I'll get an oat milk latte with honey.
Last question is, what do you want?
I want to be happy. I am really happy, but I think I'm just continuing to sink into this realization, understanding that I'm allowed to be happy. I'm allowed to really enjoy my life. It doesn't have to be painful and hard. Sure, there may be painful and hard things that happen, but I get to just thrive.
Thriving looks so good on you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It feels, the week that we're recording this, I had yesterday, today is like the Thursday after the podcast release, I released an episode on celebrating, and it was all about like, we're doing all this healing work so we can feel our thriving. Yeah. So why are we so reluctant to sinking into it?
I think it is for me. As I'm going through this process, the reluctance is, joy is an incredibly vulnerable emotion.
Yeah.
I'm terrified to feel joy, because once I feel joy, I worry it could be taken from me.
Whew. I have chills. I hosted a workshop for my program last night, and that was consistently, it was, if I feel the joy, I'll feel the grief, I'll feel the loneliness.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So much.
Totally.
Oh my God. Anything else you want to share before we go?
I just want to encourage people to embrace, or at least try, a practice of writing, even if you don't feel like a real writer. This is a piece of pushback that I hear from a lot of people when I teach this content, is, well, I'm not really a writer. And I just want to encourage people that even the published authors out there whose books you've read, who you hold close to heart, will say that same phrase to me. I know that sounds crazy, but books that you have read and have sold millions of copies, the authors will say to me, I'm not really a writer. I wasn't supposed to do this. I was in this other field and this just kind of happened to me. So I feel like that's helpful for people to hear sometimes, just to know that the idea that you're not a writer is not only not true, but it is a feeling of like imposter syndrome or something that's felt by even the writers who you really respect and admire. So.
And where can people go to find you, your favorite place on the internet?
They should go to writeyourstory.com. This will be live by the time this podcast goes live. It goes live tomorrow. So writeyourstory.com. It's a brand new resource. I'm so excited about this, because most of our resources have been built around publishing. And I'm just now releasing this. It's a free download. It's a one-page worksheet that will help you outline your personal story. And then you get 5 videos that follow up that help you answer the questions in the worksheet. So I'm so excited. It'll be ready by the time.
I'm so excited. I'm going to download it tomorrow. That sounds so exciting.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Beautiful. Thank you for tuning in to Everything Belongs. If you loved this episode, please subscribe and leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, so that others might find this podcast too. You can find the show notes and find out more about today's guests by going to madisonmorgan.com/podcast. And before you go, I want to tell you about Everything Belongs, the membership. For only $17 a month, join my monthly workshop gatherings that will serve as a playground and sacred circle to learn and explore a spirited life fully expressed in your worth, wholeness, and power. Members will have the opportunity to vote on podcast guests, pick workshop topics, send in questions to be answered live on the call, get a monthly journaling PDF, and members-only access to all of my coaching programs. If you're looking for a place to ground, gather, play, and explore all of the conversations shared here on Everything Belongs, then this is a space for you. For more information, go to madisonmorgan.com/membership. And if you're not following and chatting with me over on Instagram, please go do that now and DM me and let me know your favorite part of this episode. I cannot wait to hear from you. And until next time, remember that curiosity can be a portal to a rich life where everything truly belongs. See you next time.